This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. He was one of the founding members and first town clerk of Bennington, Vermont. He was among the so-called radicals who opposed the New York land grants in the 1700s, and he fought to make Vermont independent. He was Vermont's first chief justice, its second governor, one of the first two senators sent to represent Vermont in the U.S. Congress. He was called by his contemporaries the Old Patriot. His name? Moses Robinson. Perhaps you were thinking of Ethan Allen, the more famous of Vermont's founding fathers. Their resumes are a little bit different, but they were contemporaries who both played large roles in Vermont's politics and communities. Ethan Allen, the firebrand, gets a lot more attention from historians, and it's his name that has been co-opted and used for furniture companies, highways, military installations, and on and on. But our guest today says Moses Robinson deserves more credit than he gets for setting Vermont on the path to statehood and shaping who we have become. Robert Mello has just published a new biography called Moses Robinson and the Founding of Vermont. Mello is a state superior court judge when he's not researching Vermont history, and he joins us today to make the case for Moses Robinson. Judge Mello, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be here.
So we're going to dive pretty deeply into Moses Robinson here, but give us the back of the book version of who this guy was.
Well, Moses Robinson played a central role in the founding of Vermont, but nobody's ever heard of him. He was a leader of Vermont's revolt from New York in the early 1770s. He was a delegate at the Dorset Convention in 1776 that declared Vermont to be independent. He was a militia colonel. He was at Fort Ticonderoga, Mount Independence, when General Burgoyne attacked the fort. He was a member of Vermont's first government, the Council of Safety, and helped Bennington organize its successful defense at the Bennington Battle. He was named our first Chief Justice when the Constitution went into effect in 1778. And then 8 years later, he was president of the Constitutional Convention that debated major amendments to our initial Constitution. And he was a member of Thomas Chittenden's inner circle of closest advisors and a member of Chittenden's governing council during Vermont's most formative years.
Thomas Chittenden, of course, Vermont's first governor.
Exactly. He was also a friend of Ethan Allen and Ira Allen, and Moses Robinson largely agreed with Chittenden and Allen on most policies. But Robinson was also independent-minded, and he disagreed with Chittenden and the Allens on some important issues, most notably statehood for Vermont. And it was Robinson's break with Chittenden and the Allens over statehood that led to Robinson's election as governor in 1789. So he was also our second governor. And as governor, he oversaw the settlement of Vermont's 20-year-old dispute with New York. That cleared the way for Vermont to become the 14th state. And then when we became a state, Robinson was vice president of the convention that ratified the U.S. Constitution, and then he served as Vermont's first senator from 1791 to 1796. So he was of major importance, and yet the Allens have hijacked Vermont history, which is why nobody has heard of him. So I hope my book will restore him to his rightful place, and maybe we'll get something named after him, too.
Yeah, you want a furniture company? What are you looking for here, Judge Mello?
I'll take a courtroom.
Why, though? I mean, given that CV, given that list of accomplishments, and being really right in the thick of things and at the top of the Vermont political hierarchy for 30 years, why isn't he better known?
I really don't know. Historians haven't focused on him. There's no single place you can go to look to find information about him. I had to go to the Bennington Museum, the University of Vermont collections, the Vermont Historical Collections, which are amazing, the Vermont Archives, the New Hampshire Archives, Hardwick, Massachusetts Historical Society, to find the background information to put this all together. So it's not easy to do. It took me 10 years, so I'm not surprised it hadn't been done before.
Although, judging by the what appears to be a labor of love, this book, that doesn't sound like it was a real hardship for you to do all that research. It seems like you must have loved it, because this is really a well-researched, exhaustively researched book on Moses Robinson.
Yes, I found him and his times absolutely fascinating, and I had a wife who was very patient with me.
Well, so did Moses Robinson. He was traveling a lot, had a long marriage to Mary, who was his wife, and they had a lot of children. You talk about all of them in the book. In fact, one of his grandchildren actually became governor of Vermont as well.
So the last Democrat to be a governor in 100 years until Governor Hoff's election.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Interesting. We're talking today with Judge Robert Mello. He has written a new book about Moses Robinson, one of the forgotten founders of Vermont. And listeners, if you have a question, if you have wondered about the relationship that Ira and Ethan Allen had to the other politicians in Vermont around the Revolutionary War era, or if you want to ask Judge Mello about other things that were swirling around in Vermont before it became a state and as it became a state, now's the time. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions about Vermont history on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So Moses Robinson was born in Massachusetts. He moved with his parents and some of his siblings to the frontier, to Vermont, in 1761, when he was 20 years old, I think. And then he was given 20,000 acres of land by his father when he was 21 so that he could get married and start a family and start a career, which sounds like a pretty lovely gift. In fact, I think his family owned, you say, like half of Bennington's land at that time. And pretty quickly, he was elected Bennington's first town clerk. So what made him a good candidate in the town? How did he rise to the level even then, even at age 21, of being somebody who might be a leader?
Well, he was not – he did not have a significant education. He was pretty much homeschooled by his parents, but he had extraordinary parents. His father was a born leader. His mother read avidly. And exhibited all the traits most admired by people of women during that time. So he had great parents.
You know, you mentioned that twice. I noticed when I was reading that you made a point of saying he had exceptional parents. Is that in distinction to other leaders at the time? Is that in opposition to the Allen brothers, for example? Or did you just find them remarkable as you were reading about these parents?
I didn't mean that to contrast him with others. I think Ethan Allen's father died when he was young, so he didn't have that benefit. But I mentioned it because Moses Robinson got from his parents some of the characteristics that he displayed the rest of his life, including the belief in the equality of all people and a abiding curiosity and drive for self-improvement and a bedrock belief in the importance of public service.
So he became Bennington's first town clerk. He was also very involved in trying to preserve the New Hampshire grants. You know, we've talked on this show, and certainly people who have studied Vermont history have a sense that there were New Hampshire grants and New York grants. And as the settlers moved in and had these competing grants, depending on who gave them the land, the New Yorkers or the New Hampshire side, this became quite a big battle. And Robinson had a vested interest in preserving the New Hampshire grants. But what did he do to try to establish Vermont first on the side of New Hampshire and then as an independent entity?
Well, when settlers started buying land in Vermont in the early 1760s, everybody thought New Hampshire owned what became Vermont. And that's because the governor of New Hampshire claimed that he owned it. And he sold tons and tons of land in Vermont to unsuspecting settlers without disclosing to them that New York also claimed the same land.
Yeah, this is the underhanded Benning Wentworth, New Hampshire governor, and my ancestor, actually.
Oh, my goodness. So when New York realized what Benning Wentworth was doing, the New York governor said, "We own that land." And it had to go to the king to decide who was right. And the king decided in favor of New York. So all of a sudden, Moses Robinson and all his neighbors who owned all this land, or thought they did, under titles from New Hampshire, all of a sudden their titles were in question. And they were at risk of being evicted because the New York authorities did not recognize the validity of their deeds. And so that was the trigger that prompted the revolt.
And was he involved in the sort of mob-like terrorization of New Yorkers who had settled in Vermont at the time? We know that Ethan Allen was involved in that. Was Moses Robinson involved in the violent part of that?
Well, we know he was a leader of the revolt because he was declared to be by the governor of New York, and they arrested him or tried to arrest him, but he was rescued by his fellow radicals. So we know he was a leader, but the Green Mountain Boys didn't keep minutes. And we don't know who exactly did what. So how involved he was in the actual violence that took place, I can't say. He may very well have been, but I can't prove it.
You mentioned a moment ago that he was allied with Ira and Ethan Allen for much of his political life. What was his relationship like, from what you've been able to glean, with Ethan Allen and Ira Allen?
I think he had a close relationship with them, and right from the beginning, Ethan Allen was probably part of the group that rescued him, rescued Robinson when he was arrested and seized by the sheriff in Albany. And they agreed on most issues. And they also, the Allens also were close allies and advisors to Chittenden. So I think they were quite close.
Judge Mello, when the Revolutionary War started, Moses Robinson was the head of the Bennington Militia. It doesn't seem like he played as large a military role as some of the other Vermonters that we've heard about. Is that accurate?
That's true.
So what was his role exactly?
So he was a militia colonel. He took the place of Seth Warner when Seth Warner became head of the Green Mountain Boys. And so Robinson became the head of the militia in Bennington, and he was the head of the militia there, as well as a member of the Council of Safety at the Battle for Bennington. But after that, he played a tremendous role in the Governor's Council and in governing Vermont. And although he remained a militia colonel for many years, his political activity took priority, and he didn't have that much of a military role after the Battle of Bennington.
It sounds like the political side of things was really where his passion and his expertise lay, and people seemed to trust him to be in these leadership roles right from the start.
And there were crisis after crisis that he and Chittenden and the other council members had to deal with.
Talk a little bit about some of those, because we're talking now during the Revolutionary War, pre-statehood. What were some of the crises that this fledgling republic was dealing with?
Well, the British in Canada kept invading northern Vermont. So our early leaders had to protect the frontier. At the same time, in what is now Windham County, the majority of the population there opposed the new Vermont government. They didn't trust it. They wanted to be part of New York. So they went through a series of Yorker revolts or counter-revolts that had to be put down and dealt with. At the same time, there was a movement at Dartmouth College by a group of leaders in the area that is now Windsor County to try to create a new state centered on the Connecticut River, comprising of the western third of New Hampshire and the eastern half of Vermont. So there was that effort to split Vermont up. Plus, there was tremendous economic disruption. People had little food to eat. The early council had to deal with finding ways to prevent food from being sold out of state. And there's just one crisis after another.
Yeah, there's at one point during the Revolutionary War where the leaders in Vermont say, basically, if you are north of a certain place, I can't remember exactly where geographically, but it sounded like maybe southern Addison County, northern Rutland County, we can't protect you. So just move south if you want to be protected. Otherwise, you're kind of on your own. We just can't protect everybody who's living in Vermont from all of these forces.
We had a small militia and not much money to fund it with. We could only defend the southern part of Vermont. Anybody living north of Rutland on the west side of the mountains, if they were living there comfortably, they were presumed to be working with the British because the government couldn't protect them. And if they weren't working with the British, they would have had the houses burned and their crops destroyed.
There was a lot of political maneuvering at this time that we don't often think about because we sort of rush ahead to get, you know, more towards the end of the Revolutionary War and into statehood. But the leaders in Vermont at this time were trying to deal with putting off the Yorkers, putting off New York's government, who was trying to encroach on Vermont, trying to figure out what to do with the eastern side of things, where first Vermont was annexing towns from New Hampshire and then New Hampshire was angry. And so there was this debate, as you said, among some of the Vermonters about whether to go back and be part of New Hampshire or become their own place, and how is this going to shift the balance of power? I was surprised to read about how much political maneuvering there was, even before Vermont really knew what it wanted to be.
Yes. At one time, Vermont was twice the size that it is now because Vermont annexed the western third of New Hampshire and large parts of eastern New York. That almost led to civil war in northern New England because neither New Hampshire nor New York liked the idea. And they raised militias and there were confrontations and there was bloodshed. At the same time, the British governor in Canada, realizing that Congress repeatedly rejected statehood for Vermont, tried to take advantage of that situation and tried to persuade Ethan Allen to persuade Vermont's leaders to return to the British Empire because they couldn't rely on Congress. So it was a very complex situation with constant moving parts, and the fact that these leaders who, without any formal education or training, handled the situation as well as they did is really remarkable.
We're talking today with Judge Robert Mello. He's a Superior Court judge and the author of the new biography, Moses Robinson and the Founding of Vermont. We've got some questions from listeners we're going to get to in just a moment as we look at this forgotten founder of Vermont, Moses Robinson. Judge Mello spent the last 10 years working on a book about this revolutionary Vermonter, and we are hearing more today. So if you have a question, you can post it at vpr.net by clicking on the Vermont Edition page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today with Judge Robert Mello, who's written an extensively researched biography of one of Vermont's founding fathers, Moses Robinson. Let us know what questions you have about this forgotten founder, how he and the Allen brothers interacted, and why he fought for Vermont's entry into the Union. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Great book. I'm halfway through it. How does Moses Malone influence current-day Vermont? Let's say, just transport Moses Malone from the 1790s to right here, and he knows enough to be able to talk with everybody. What does he talk about? What are his concerns about current days for Vermont, the health of the state?
Mark, thanks. And I think you mean Moses Robinson. But go ahead.
Moses Robinson. Yeah. I'm thinking about the basketball player.
That's right. Judge Mello, go ahead.
Well, you know, he dealt with a lot of the same problems we're dealing with today. Loggerhead in government, economic downturns, protracted wars.
Federalism,
yes, exactly. And dirty political campaign tactics and all that sort of thing. He was dealing with them all back then. So I think he would feel right at home at today, and he would have a lot to offer in terms of suggestions of what he and his generation did that worked and what he and his generation did that didn't work. We could learn a lot about our own problems today by reading about how he and his colleagues dealt with those same problems back in his own day.
Well, let's talk about one of them. This isn't necessarily a huge issue in Vermont, but we're hearing a lot about this around the country, and that's voting rights, because he was involved in issues surrounding Vermont's voting rights really early on when there was an effort to take away some of the voting rights that had been put in place in Vermont that allowed all free men to vote. And there was a move to make it so that it was only property owners. Can you talk a little bit about his perspective on that?
Yes. In the first constitution, the Vermont 1777 constitution, that was the first constitution in the United States that recognized universal male suffrage. Any male could vote if he was 21 years old and took the Freeman's Oath. Didn't have to own property. That was not true in any other state. 8 years later, the Council of Censors, which was the majority of whom were people who ultimately became Federalists, tried to ram through a number of amendments to the Constitution, one of which was to take away the right for everybody to vote and only allow voting by people who were property owners. Moses Robinson was president of that convention and was in a position to influence the course of debates. And thanks to his leadership, that convention rejected that amendment and preserved the grassroots, bottom-up democracy that he had worked all his life to establish. And that is part of what makes Vermont a special place. It's part of what gives Vermont its special character, our continuing reliance on grassroots democratic participation by everybody.
So you see that as a direct tie back to Moses Robinson, something that we hold of value in our communities and in our way of doing business and doing politics today. You think can tie actually pretty directly back to Moses Robinson.
Directly back to Moses Robinson. We can thank him and those who supported him at that convention for the fact that we still have universal suffrage by all people.
Let's go to Mimi. She's on the line with us from Williston. Hi, Mimi. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello, Judge Mello. This is Mimi Crane. And
hi, Mimi.
I am calling I'm just calling to know whether my question is, when you started your research 10 years ago, did you know the significant impact your research would have on the history of Vermont in vis-a-vis Moses Robinson?
Well, I first heard of Moses Robinson decades ago as a young lawyer. I looked up who our first Chief Justice was and saw the name Moses Robinson, but couldn't find anything else about him. Over the years, I read more and more about him, and I discovered that he was involved in almost all aspects of Vermont's founding. But still, you couldn't find one place that would discuss his accomplishments and his deeds. So 10 years ago, I decided he deserved a biography, and I met with some friends who were historians, and they encouraged me to do that. And I started the intense research 10 years ago.
So when you were doing all of this research, did you think throughout it, I've got something good here? I mean, did it build, or was it this sense of, I'm going to push this through. I know what I've got, and I just need to find the research.
Well, I knew he deserved recognition. When I started 10 years ago, I didn't know that he would turn out to have been one of the most important founders of Vermont. That was a surprise. But the evidence kept proving it.
Moses Robinson was also Vermont's first Chief Justice. And we should say at the time, he was in the executive branch of government, and he was also the Chief Justice. There wasn't that separation of powers that there
right.
is now. When you look at his role in court proceedings and as a justice, I mean, he had no training in the law when he was first appointed to that position. What was his sort of methodology or strategy or ethos?
He was appointed to the court as part of a political compromise. So he had no legal training, as you indicated. In fact, none of the five justices who were appointed had any legal training at all. Very early on, as Chief Justice, there was a major criminal case in what is now Windham County. There was one of the first of the Yorker revolts against this new government of Vermont. And Moses Robinson went down to preside over the criminal trials. Ethan Allen, who had been the leader of the Green Mountain Boys and who had used kangaroo courts to, quote, try people and then convict them and then whip them. He urged Robinson to continue using those same vigilante methods, but Robinson refused. He said he was going to follow the rule of law, and as a result of that, many of the defendants, their charges were dismissed because they weren't legally sufficient. Ethan Allen was very upset with that because he thought Robinson was letting people go that he certainly would have never let go. But Robinson insisted on following the rule of law, even though he wasn't law trained. And to me as a judge today, that's one of the most inspiring things about him, that he insisted on the rule of law at a very early point as Chief Justice.
We're talking today with Judge Bob Mello. He's a state superior court judge, and he's the author of a new biography. It's called Moses Robinson and the Founding of Vermont. And we're learning a little bit more about one of the founding fathers of the state who is by and large not remembered much today. And Judge Mello thinks that ought to change. He's certainly found a passion for Moses Robinson and is telling us about some of the reasons that he helped to shape Vermont into what it is today. If you have a question for Judge Mello, you can call 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a question from Joan, who wants to know if Moses Robinson is an ancestor of the Ferrisburg Robinsons, whose homestead was part of the Underground Railroad.
I don't believe so. Robinson was a very common name back then. In fact, there was another Moses Robinson who was also active in Vermont's early formative years, although not nearly as important. And so I had to actually learn the handwriting of the two and in order to be able to separate which Moses Robinson was writing which documents.
No kidding.
So Robinson was a common name. I don't believe he was related to the Ferrisburg Robinsons.
And who had the better handwriting of the two Moses Robinsons who were contemporaries?
They both were challenging to read.
Moses Robinson, as I mentioned earlier, and as you have pointed out, was the second governor of Vermont. This was before Vermont was a state, and it was in between terms of Thomas Chittenden. But he was only governor for one term. He ran for re-election a couple of times and wasn't elected. And in fact, when he was governor, he wasn't elected by popular vote. He was elected by the legislature because Thomas Chittenden hadn't received a plurality. So was he – I mean, you've talked a lot about what a statesman he was and how important he was. But did he not have the stature or the respect of the people to be chosen governor by the people during his own lifetime?
Thomas Chittenden was immensely popular. In his own lifetime, they named a county after him. He was just immensely popular because he was our first governor. And he was – my admiration for him as I did this book continued to soar. I have just tremendous respect for Thomas Chittenden. He was a great founding father. And Robinson and he agreed on almost everything, but they disagreed on statehood. And it was because of that disagreement that they broke. And when Chittenden failed to get enough votes for a straight election in 1789, and that election went to the legislature. The legislature was controlled by people who also agreed Vermont should be a state. And so they chose Robinson over Chittenden, and Robinson oversaw the settlement with New York that cleared the way for statehood. We became a state just 5 months after he stepped down. So he was instrumental in our becoming the 14th state. But the immensely popular Chittenden was reelected afterwards.
Well, and as you mentioned in the book, Robinson had a kind of a tenuous position. He was an anti-federalist, and yet he was for statehood. So he had to sort of navigate these various waters and try to keep together the different factions of Vermont politics in those years. Judge Mello, as we think about Moses Robinson now and as we have this body of research that you've done, what do you hope happens in schools and as people think about Vermont's founding? How do you hope that Moses Robinson is remembered?
I hope he's remembered not just for his accomplishments but also for the person he was. In addition to all the things he did, he was also an admirable man. He was a family man, a leader of his church, a public servant, courageous, and I think his greatest legacy is his 40 years of public service and honorable, honest. If he lost an election, that was fine. If he won the election, it was fine. He neither gloated over victories nor whined over defeat. And he never took pot shots at his opponents. He was a very decent fellow, someone who I hope the children of Vermont will find inspiration and follow his lead.
Do you find any inspiration in his life for the work that you do as a judge?
I do. His insistence on following the rule of law is something that inspires me every day in court to follow the law and not try to make it up as you go. That's the only way to assure justice is done, and he started it.
Judge Robert Mello is a state superior court judge and the author of the new book, Moses Robinson and the Founding of Vermont. Judge Mello, thank you very much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you, Jane. It's great to be here.
Coming up on Vermont Edition, we'll talk with environmental leader Gus Speth about his new book. It's a memoir that ties together race, politics, and the environment. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. James Gustav Speth grew up in South Carolina, blissfully unaware of the racial tension that was roiling around him. It wasn't until he went to college up north that he saw some of the injustice that he was shielded from as a child. Though he did do a little work organizing in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, Gus Speth has long felt he didn't do enough. He hasn't made the same mistake when it comes to the environmental movement. Now a professor at Vermont Law School, Speth co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council, he founded the World Resources Institute, and he worked on environmental issues for the Carter and Clinton administrations. In his new memoir, Angels by the River, Speth draws a connection between the civil rights era of the 1960s and the environmental movement of today.
Well, to complete the circle, I actually think that we were powerfully motivated, those of us who got involved in starting this new wave of environmentalism in 1970, for example, with the launching of the Natural Resources Defense Council, which a group of us were involved with. We were powerfully influenced by the civil rights movement, both professionally and personally. We had been in law school and we had studied the civil rights cases, and we believed if you got an issue into the Supreme Court and into the legislation in Washington, you could get something done. And that's what we wanted to do for the environment. And on a more personal level, I was coming out of a period of having grown up in this very segregated southern town, small town called Orangeburg, and had absorbed this Jim Crow as part of life. I mean, it just is the way things were. And at Yale, when I had these bad ideas really knocked out of me and came to my senses about the race issue and segregation and racism in America, I realized that I hadn't been part of this great movement, this great civil rights movement, except in some modest respects. And I sort of made a personal decision that I didn't ever want to be on the sideline of history again if I could help it. And so when we had this opportunity to help launch the new environmental movement that started with the first Earth Day in 1970, well, it was a natural thing. I just went for it.
Yeah, you do write about growing up in the segregated South and the ability to be a white child who is able to remain sort of blissfully unaware of the massive injustice surrounding you. And when you talk about having the sense knocked into you or some of your ideas knocked out of you. In fact, at Yale, you had a couple of guys, northern guys, come up and not quite rough you up, but say in no uncertain terms, we expect you to treat blacks nicely.
Well, it wasn't quite that polite. Yeah. I was a freshman, and I don't know that I had done anything to provoke this, but I was called out of a study room and slammed up against the wall by two upperclassmen who basically said, if you ever use the N-word around here or do anything da-da-da-da-da, we're going to get you. And on that, in that vein, and I was totally shaken up. But I must say, the book is Angels, by the River, and they aren't my typical angel in the book, but they were angels of a sort because it shook me up and made me think.
You said that when you were at Yale Law School and thinking about what you wanted to do, you didn't want to be on the sidelines of history again. So when you and your colleagues were trying to figure out what to do and you were moved to want to form a law firm that dedicated itself to the environment, why the environment? Were you looking at something that was a passion for you, or were you saying, I think this is where the action's going to be at and I want to be there?
Well, I think it was both. There was a group of us. We had all had a background that sort of attached us in different ways to the environment and to the nature and the outdoors. On the other hand, it seemed to us that it was the right moment. We were getting out of law school. We were children of the 60s. We wanted to do something in the public interest, to do something to better society. When we started to build this organization that eventually became the Natural Resources Defense Council, we certainly weren't taught environmental law. There was no such thing, nor did we know we were going to have such powerful laws to work with, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, all of which were still in the future. But we did sense that something was coming.
I want to ask you about one of the issues, the early issues that the Natural Resources Defense Council worked on, which was nuclear power. And I'm curious how you feel about nuclear power now. Our current president has been supportive of nuclear as a power source, despite the fact that the long-term storage issue hasn't been solved. But have your positions on nuclear power changed or shifted over the years?
Not really. I think Amory Lovin said it best way back in the early 1970s when he said it's kind of like using a chainsaw to cut butter. The work that we did, particularly at the Natural Resources Defense Council, was aimed at heading off a different generation, a new generation of nuclear power reactors. And the Atomic Energy Commission at that point planned to have several hundred breeder reactors built in the country by the turn of the century. And these reactors are even more dangerous than the ones that we have today, and not only produce waste that no one now still knows quite what to do with, but produce a lot of plutonium, which they planned on extracting and recycling as nuclear fuel. Now, plutonium, of course, is very weapons available material to make nuclear weapons dirty and real. And so this new generation of reactors was a big threat, bigger even than the current ones that we have. And I think it I look back on that effort as one of the things that I'm proudest of, really, in my environmental work. We did, thanks in the end to President Jimmy Carter, we were able to slow up the whole process and make it a political issue. And in the end, Carter killed it.
So you're not supportive of creating new nuclear power plants today to solve some of our short-term energy issues?
I don't think we need them. Hmm. If we get serious about efficiency, renewables, and get serious about what our real priorities are. I think some of the people who are advocating for nuclear envision an energy future, which is just has vastly more, many times the level of energy production that we have today, and this is a future which brings with it so much growth in the wrong places and of the wrong things that I think solving the climate problem it was going to be vastly more difficult, perhaps probably impossible. Not that we are going to solve it in a complete sense, anyhow. But we need to get our heads straight about what's really important in our society and in our economy, and aim for a very low energy future.
You were already working on climate change issues for the Carter administration in the 1970s, and you say that we knew then what needed to be done. And in fact, you say that U.S. inaction on climate change is, quote, the greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic. What did we know in the 70s that we should have been acting on then?
Well, I was chairman of the Carter's Council on Environmental Quality, and I was approached by one of our great environmental leaders, Rafe Pomerantz, and a group of scientists led by Gordon McDonnell and Roger Revelle and George Woodwell. And they said to me, we want you to take the climate issue to the president. And this was 1979. And I said, well, get me a report, and I will. And they did a report, and it basically sounded the alarm in 1979. And I took it to the president. The Department of Energy got very upset and reacted very negatively to our report. But we kept working on it at the Council on Environmental Quality. And at that point, we knew enough about the climate issue that we put up a limit on the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we even put a number on that, which turns out to be not far off the mark of what is tolerable. I mean, and you know, the great tragedy is, the tremendous tragedy is that here we, you know, here we are, you know, 34, 35 years later, having wasted decades when we could have approached this issue in a sensible and reasonable way.
You mentioned in the book that one of the failures that you see of the early environmental movement was to build that grassroots electoral support, build support with the people that could have made some changes in how we elect officials and what they are fighting for. And then that today the environmental movement doesn't see the connection between social justice and the environment, which in some ways brings us back around to what you discussed earlier in the book with the civil rights movement and social justice. What do you see now needs to be done to make the connection between social justice and the environment? And why do we need to make that connection?
Well, I think first, if you look at the climate march that just happened in New York City with over 300,000 people, mostly from the U.S. but also from many other countries, there was a fusion there of climate justice and social justice and the climate issue and environmental issue. So I think we're beginning to see these two coming together. But, you know, you just ask this. What is an environmental issue? And you know, the normal reaction is, well, it's air pollution, water pollution, biodiversity loss, climate change. And that's right. It's all those things. But what if you answer that an environmental issue is whatever has a big effect on environmental outcomes, on the prospects for environmental success, on really leaving a country and a world that fit for our children and grandchildren? And then immediately when you ask that question, you have to conclude, well, our politics is probably the biggest factor in determining environmental outcomes. And, you know, the environmental community needs to be extremely active in pro-democracy political reforms. We need to a host of political changes that we need to be made to sustain and really make robust again American democracy. And environmentalists need to be in the forefront of that. And in a similar way, you know, how can you expect to make environmental progress when there's such a vast economic insecurity across the land? When people are struggling with poor jobs and poor pay and living paycheck to paycheck, half the country, and poverty at a huge level, and 40% of the families in low-income households, that is less than twice the poverty level. In those circumstances, people are fearful. Labor union members are fearful. You just have to say, well, it's going to hurt the economy. It's going to cost us jobs. It's going to raise prices. And people back off in their support. And so we need to deal with that for their own reasons. There's plenty of reasons to deal with. But we also need to deal with it if we ever expect to make the kind of progress on environment that we need so desperately now.
Well, given that, do you have any hope?
Oh, I think things are changing. I think the great march in New York was a sign of change. We're seeing a flurry of activity around this theme of building a new economy. People are talking seriously about the need not only to work within the system to get reforms, but to change the system so that it's not delivering such bad results economically, socially, politically, environmentally. And what's happening at the local level in our country? I mean, we see it in Vermont. It's actually happening at the state level often in Vermont. But across the country, we're seeing so much going on at the community level. Led by the food movement in a way, but new forms of enterprise, public-private hybrids, profit, not-for-profit hybrids, social enterprises, for-benefit corporations, and lots of of community-oriented developments, community investment corporations, community development corporations. I mean, a lot is going on to bring the future into the present in our localities, in our communities, in our cities. And so there's also a somewhat perverse reason for hope, which is that I think we haven't seen the end of crises. And I mean, the good news and the bad news is that the climate issue is going to force a tremendous change.
James Gustav Speth's new memoir is called Angels by the River. Gus Speth, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane. It was a pleasure.
And that will wrap up today's program. Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. If there's anything that you ever miss on the program and want to hear it again, just go to vpr.net. You'll find our full archives, and you can find out how to podcast the program. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Isla Yersel. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.